So this morning, having looked already at God's omniscience and his omnipresence, we continue our study of systematic theology with a look at the third omni of God's perfections, as it were, and that is God's omnipotence. Omnipotence is not really a difficult word to understand. If you understand the word omni means all, and you understand the word potency or potent means powerful, then we understand that God is all-powerful. And that's really an understatement. I don't think there's anyone alive who has even the slightest understanding of who God is who would argue that God is not all-powerful. If you want a more textbook definition, which I think is essential to our understanding of this particular perfection, it would be as follows. God is all-powerful and able to do whatever he wills. Now, here's the important thing to understand. Since his will is limited by his nature, God can do everything that is in harmony with his perfections. Now, there's some who might be uncomfortable, recoil slightly at the suggestion that God is limited. But as we've said a few times already with regard to God's perfections, perfection itself is limited. Limited to what? Itself. To be perfect is really the ultimate limitation. Because to be perfect means you cannot change for the worse, because that would mean that you were never perfect to begin with, and you cannot change for the better, which would also indicate that you weren't perfect to start out with. So if you want to put someone in a really tightly, hermetically sealed box, you're free to put God in that box of utter limitation. Now, what does that mean? Are we saying that there are things that God cannot do? Yes. Yes. The key being, he cannot do that which would be in violation of his own perfections, or in violation of his own sovereign and perfect will. This is really a necessary way of clarifying some of the silly statements people make about God. You know, how many of you have ever heard someone ask, well, could God create a stone so heavy that he couldn't pick it up? Right? And to the layman, I mean, that sets their head spinning, and they're like, wow, that is really, that's a conundrum, isn't it? Could God create a rock so heavy that he couldn't pick it up? Well, that's not the answer. I mean, that's not even the right question. That question is, on its surface, an invalid question. The answer to that question, by the way, is he wouldn't. Not that he can't. God would not put himself in a situation that would violate any of his perfections. And that's exactly what that sort of scenario would do. For God to do one thing that would render him powerless to do another would violate his perfection of omnipotence. Right? It's sort of like the question of what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. Anybody care to venture a guess? What happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object? Does the force stop? No, it's unstoppable. It can't just stay there. Yes. It's a logical contradiction. They can't both be true. You cannot have an unstoppable force meeting an immovable object. One of those things is going to prove itself to not be true. So in the case of God creating a rock so big that he couldn't pick it up, one of those things would render him not omnipotent. You see how that works? In fact, there are a whole host of things that God can't do. And we read these in Scripture. What are some of those? Well, God can't go back on his word. You know, And so people who get nervous when we suggest that God can't do things, just turn to your scriptures and understand God can't turn back on his word. As Paul has written in 2 Timothy 2:13, if we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. So there's a direct statement of something that God cannot do. This is also brought out in 2 Corinthians 1:20, where we read that for as many as are the promises of God, in him they are yes. In other words, God cannot fail to keep that which he has promised. According to Hebrews 6:18, God cannot lie. According to Habakkuk 1:13 and James 1:13, God cannot sin. In our study of God's immutability, we learned that by the very definition of the word, God cannot change. But let me just point this out. None of these things indicate inability. None of these things indicate inability. What they do is convey the truth that our omnipotent God cannot and will not do anything that goes against his perfect nature and being. He can't violate his own perfection, right? Which is another can't. So what are some scriptures that we might point to in order to establish or defend the doctrine of God's omnipotence? What are some of the things that come to your mind when we talk about God being all-powerful? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Creation.
Creation. Creation. How powerful is God? God is so powerful that he created everything that is ex nihilo. He created everything that is from nothing. And how did he do that? With a word. That's powerful. That's powerful. For an eternal, almighty God to simply say, let there be. I was going to say, and there be's. Let there be, and there is. That's power, folks. That's unbridled, unlimited power. Is there anything that God would desire to call into being that he can't call into being? No. No. This is what primarily establishes his omnipotence, the creation. In Genesis 18:14, let me give you just a few examples of God's unlimited power. In Genesis 18:14, you'll recall when Sarah was told that she would give birth at an advanced age, she laughed. She laughed. And how did the Lord respond? The Lord responded with a rhetorical question. The Lord responded by saying, is anything too difficult for the Lord? And what's the answer to that? Nope. There's nothing too difficult for the Lord. At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. And what happened? She had a son. Which, by the way, she named Isaac, which means laughter. Because it would always be a reminder to her that she at one time doubted the omnipotence of God. At one time, she laughed in derision. This was not a laugh of hilarity. This was not a laugh of joy. Her laugh was completely one of derision. Yeah, right. I'm going to have a boy. I'm over 90 years old. But she had a boy. And she named that boy Laughter. In Psalm 114:3, the psalmist declares, somebody check me on that, maybe 115:3. Just sounds more like 115:3. Somebody check that for me. The Lord declares, our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. Is it what?
115.
Good. The mind's still working. 115:3. But our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. Is there anything beyond his capability if he's able to do whatever he wants? No. Jeremiah 32:17. Jeremiah prays, "Ah, sovereign Lord, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you. Nothing is too hard for you." And then down in verses 26 and 27 of that same passage, we read that the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah saying, "I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me?" And again, it's a rhetorical question. The answer of which is, no, there's nothing too hard for you. In Luke chapter 1, we see the exchange between Mary and the angel Gabriel, who had come to tell her about her role in giving birth to Jesus. And when Mary asks, "How will this be since I am a virgin?" How did Gabriel respond? He said, "Nothing is impossible with God. Nothing is impossible with God." So in addition to these statements, and you can find these throughout the scriptures, but in addition to these, in addition to attributing things like God's work of creation, his providence, man's redemption from sin as evidence or effects of his almighty power, we have the name Almighty itself. When we refer to God as being God Almighty, a lot of people realize that that's a description of God's omnipotence, but what a lot of people don't realize is that's actually one of his names. El Shaddai means God the Almighty One. God the one in whom there is no lack of power. So I think the doctrine is easy enough to understand from an intellectual standpoint, right? I mean, even though we can't grasp that kind of power, even though we have no way to cram all of the infinite things that we might understand about God's power into our finite minds, we kind of understand what it means for God to have unlimited power, at least on a conceptual level. What's most difficult, I think, about the doctrine of God's omnipotence is understanding it in practical terms. In other words, what does it mean to you and me as we live our daily lives that God is, in fact, omnipotent? I mean, what effect does that have on us each and every day? Well, for the believer, this really should be a no-brainer. The realization that God is all-powerful, that God is omnipotent, should serve as one of the greatest comforts that we possess. The reason that you are entitled to any assurance at all is because God is omnipotent. Because nothing can thwart his plan. Because nothing can stay his hand. The reason you have for your assurance is based squarely. You know, we've talked before about it being based squarely in God's immutability. Well, this is the same thing. God's immutability simply flows from his omnipotence. The reason God is unchangeable is because he is all-powerful. And nothing can stay his hand. Nothing can thwart his sovereign plan. Because God is able to do anything and everything necessary to ensure your well-being and mine, and ultimately to make good on his promise to save us and love us for eternity, what's the ripple effect of that in terms of practicality? Well, the ripple effect of that assurance that we have is that there shouldn't be anything capable of discouraging us. There shouldn't be anything capable. Now understand this, I'm going to make you feel about that tall because that's how tall I've felt all week. Understand that the doctrine of God's omnipotence, properly understood, means that you should not be discouraged about anything, you should not be upset about anything in this life. Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about the fact that whenever you complain about anything, you're complaining against God and his providence? Anytime anything upsets you, even with the assurance that whatever God does omnipotently, he does for your good and his glory, any complaints we have are complaints directly at God himself, who has deemed that these things are best for us. at this point, you know, even some who consider themselves to be fairly strong believers, you know, might be tempted to say something like, well, you know, I know what you're saying, and I can certainly on some level appreciate what you're saying, but if that's true, then why do I continue to worry? Why am I so easily upset by things that happen to me in this temporal world? Why am I so easily plagued with things like what I would consider problems? Doubt, worry, financial issues, health concerns. Why do I worry when I acknowledge, at least with my mouth, that I understand that God is, in fact, omnipotent, all-powerful, able to do whatever needs to be done on my behalf? Why do I continue to be plagued with those things? Well, I'll tell you why. It's as Dana has mentioned a couple of times already, and a few others of you. The reason we still worry, the reason we're still upset, the reason that we still only merely provide lip service to God's omnipotence is because our God is not nearly big enough. Our God is not often, in our minds, the same God presented in Holy Scripture. Our God is a God of our own making. Our God is a God who is at our beck and call. Our God is a God who exists only to help, nurture, sustain, please, all of those good, positive things for me. And sadly, this is the modern gospel, is it not? The modern gospel is, if you want to live your best life now, if you want to assure your own health, wealth, and happiness, then become a believer, and all of your problems will just vanish. You know, that might be true in Willy Wonka's world. That's not Christianity. As a matter of fact, I've referred to that as Willy Wonka Christianity, little c, right? Because the truth of the matter is, when Jesus called his disciples, he called them to their own death. When Jesus gathered the disciples around him, he promised them only one thing, and that is that if they were faithful to him, they would endure the same things as him. He said, don't be surprised when these things happen. But at the same time, none of those things should be able to shake our resolve in the confidence we have in an omnipotent God. In our remaining flesh, we are all at one time or another, and to one degree or another, guilty of denying God's omnipotence. We're told repeatedly throughout the Word, and you know this, we're told repeatedly that we've been redeemed, that we've been secured in that redemption by the God who made all things, by the God who controls all things, the sovereign God who's able to do more things than we can ask or even imagine, Ephesians 3:20, a God who performs wonders that we can't fathom and miracles that can't be counted, Job 9:10, a God who, according to Daniel 4:35, does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth, and no one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? And we still find ways to refuse to acknowledge who he truly is. And again, why is that? It's because, like I said last week, as R.C. Sproul once said, we've turned God into a cosmic bellhop. As I said last week, we've made God our servant, not the other way around. A.W. Tozer, and this was back in the 50s, A.W. Tozer once noted that the heaviest obligation lying upon the Christian church today is to purify and elevate her concept of God until it is once more worthy of him and of her. We need to purify and elevate our view of God using the Scriptures, understanding that God is not our servant, understanding that God owes us nothing. except wrath for eternity. A.W. Pink was of the same opinion. And I've quoted this before, but it's certainly germane to what we're talking about this morning. A.W. Pink said, the God of this century, he's talking about the 20th century, but I guarantee you, if it's possible, he's rolling over in his grave right now looking at what's going on in the world today. Remember, A.W. Pink, this is in the 40s or the 50s. How much worse have we gotten since then? But he says, the God of this century no more resembles the sovereign of holy writ than does the dim flickering of a candle the glory of the midday sun. The God who is talked about in the average pulpit, spoken about in the ordinary Sunday school, mentioned in much of the religious literature of the day, and preached in most of the so-called Bible conferences, is a figment of human imagination, an invention of maudlin sentimentality. The heathen outside the pale of Christendom form gods of wood and stone, while millions of heathen inside Christendom manufacture a god out of their carnal minds. It's true, is it not? We've put God in the box of our own making. God is not truly omnipotent. Because we reason thusly, if God is truly omnipotent, then why do I experience some of the things I experience? Couldn't he just wipe those things away? Couldn't he just cause those things to dissipate by his omnipotence? Of course he could. But he's not duty bound to do so. This is where the wires get crossed. Again, God doesn't owe you and me anything except wrath for eternity. So the question comes down to this: is God not bigger than your greatest problems? Is he not bigger than your greatest problems? Of course he is. Is he not able to rid you of worry and doubt? He is. And again, the real issue that much of the time we insist on attempting to do everything ourselves, you know, we often attempt to do everything under our own power, don't we? We want to solve our own problems. We want to be our own people. We want to address our own concerns. We want to, you know, do everything we can to avoid the upset that comes our way, and so on and so forth. Until what? Until what?
Until we fall flat on our face.
And then do what?
Help me.
Yes! For many of us, prayer is a last resort. For many of us, dependence on a sovereign, omnipotent God is our last ditch effort to solve the problems that we've attempted to solve ourselves. And what is that but an admission that we really don't trust in God's omnipotence? We all say we trust in God's sovereignty. We all say that whatever God ordains is right. We all say that whatever happens, happens for our good and his glory. Those things are easy to say until something happens to you that you don't like. Something's happened to that baby back there that's not working out too well. So the question is, do you really trust in God's omnipotence? And there is tremendous blessing in knowing and living with the knowledge that he's infinitely more power than we can even think or imagine. If we'll just dwell on that, if we'll just focus on that every moment of every day, then we might just find that having a right perspective of who God really is as a first line of defense I'm upsetting that baby for some reason. I hope I'm not having the same reaction as some of you. If so, please don't bleed. Please don't cry. It's okay. But again, I think if we truly understood, and this is another element of prayer, is it not? Going to the Lord and saying to Him, admitting to Him, I don't understand everything that's happening to me. I don't understand how this particular situation could be for my good. It hurts. It upsets me. It bothers me. But resigning ourselves to an omnipotent God and saying, Lord, not my will be done, but your will. The ultimate example is Jesus in the garden, is it not? Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But do you realize if the cup had indeed passed from him and Jesus just departed and went back to his seat at the right hand of the majesty on high, you and I would have no hope of being saved. You realize that what Jesus did was the ultimate good. And even in his humanity, he couldn't see that. He was blinded for a time, was he not? We've talked about the kenosis, about how Jesus intentionally and willfully divested himself of the prerogative to use his divinity. That was one of those times where as a human, he needed to know what it felt like to be totally and utterly abandoned by God. This is why he cried out on the cross, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? And what's interesting there, the emphasis is on the you and the me. I don't know if you pick up on that when you read that passage. It's not a case of the woe is me's. Jesus, knowing that he is the Son of God, God come in flesh, fully God and fully man, cries out to the Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? What did I do? Well, that wasn't the question either, was it? Because we don't have God's answer, but the answer to that question would be, you didn't do anything. But I'm taking the sin of all those knuckleheads that need your substitutionary atonement. And you're going through what you're going through for their benefit. And what did Jesus ultimately do? He resigned himself to that, didn't he? He caught himself in his humanity. And he says, but not my will be done, but yours. We should live with the same mindset. I don't care. I mean, I do care, but it doesn't matter. You know, just for the record, I say that I don't care a lot. And when I say that, I mean, I don't mean I don't care. What I mean is that it doesn't matter. Does that make sense? Because one of them is very impersonal and even hateful. I don't mean that ever. I do care. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. If you're a child of God, it doesn't matter what you're going through. It doesn't matter what temporary inconveniences you face in this body of death that you'll one day be freed from. What matters is whether or not you're able to see everything and anything that happens to you as coming from an omnipotent God who is able to solve that, but is not doing so for your own good and for His glory. The minute we can truly wrap our brains around that, the better off we'll be spiritually. I think one of the probably going to make Dana cry here, but one of the greatest examples of that type of mentality is her mother. That woman has been through everything imaginable in terms of family, in terms of sickness, in terms of, you know, and without fail, her every response, it's funny how she says this, you know, Dana exhibits, you don't mind me saying that, right? She exhibits the doubt and the worry and the concern. Well, Mom, what are you going to do? And her mom, every time, well, Dana, what is there to do? But just trust in God. I mean, I admire that kind of faith. Diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at 80 years old. Going through chemo, going through all these treatments and acting as if, nah, it's no big deal. What do you want for dinner? Never missed a beat. Why? I believe her faith sustained her. I believe that certain knowledge of the omnipotence of God. God is able, but he doesn't owe me. I believe that mentality will propel us to greater heights of spiritual understanding, spiritual well-being. But if God is your cosmic bellhop, if God is there at your beck and call, if you've manufactured this type of God in your mind that's only there to serve you, not the other way around, you might very well feel slighted when things don't go your way. But for those who do understand, we're never slighted. We're never slighted. Why? Because whatever my God ordains is right. That kind of leads me just to a final thought here. And that is, I need to say a word to those of you who are without Christ this morning. If you're without Christ, you have no way of understanding the omnipotence of God. I mean, not like the believer. The believer can, we can appropriate the omnipotence of God as our own. We can face even the direst of circumstances knowing that our God is able. Our God is able. Now, if you're an unbeliever, you don't have any concept of that. You might have a concept of this deity who is powerful and who is capable. And yeah, you might have that, but not in a very personal way like the believer. The real difference is this doctrine, as I've just said, is a source of comfort and assurance to the believer. But if you're an unbeliever, this is not a source of comfort and assurance. You need to know that. This is not in any way a source of encouragement for you. As a matter of fact, God's omnipotence for the unbeliever is a death sentence. Right? Some years ago, I was having a conversation with an unbeliever. Back then, my go-to passage was Philippians 2:10. Right? Some of you, that's still a go-to passage. Some of you don't have any idea what I'm talking about. But in Philippians 2:10, that's where Paul says that there's coming a day upon which every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And I remember telling this individual that he was of the particularly adamant type in his atheism. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, "Not me." I'll never forget it. He said, "Even God can't make me bow the knee." I looked around for lightning bolts. But when he said that, I was really impressed with what God did in me, because I was overcome with a sense of calm. I was immediately overcome with a sense of certainty, unlike I've experienced many times since. But I remember just staring at him long enough to make him extremely uncomfortable. And he asked me, he says, "So what makes you so sure that I'm going to bow the knee?" And I said to him, "I know this because the God who spoke everything into existence, the God who governs the movement of every single molecule in the universe, the God who has told me that this is true, will put even you on your knees. I know it as sure as I've got a nose on my face. You as an unbeliever think you're 10 feet tall and bulletproof. You think you're impervious to the strength, the omnipotence of a God that you don't even believe in. Make no mistake about it. You will bow the knee." And the question is, as it's always been, will you bow now or will you bow later? Will you bow now willingly or will you bow then under compulsion? It's one thing to have a low view of God. In other words, it's one thing to have a God who's not big enough. We can work on those things. We can develop a proper understanding of those things through the study of His Word. But it's another thing entirely to profess no God at all and live under the delusion that you're the master of your own fate, the captain of your own soul. So, again, I would encourage anyone here this morning who's an unbeliever to consider one day you'll face this omnipotent God. And as we'll learn in the next hour, should you die in your condition of unbelief, when you bow the knee, it won't be out of loyalty. It won't be out of love. It won't be out of obedience. It'll be the last thing you do before being consigned to an eternity in hell. Think on that. Seriously consider that. Now, I'm not naive enough to suspect that unbelievers are like, oh, well, thank you so much for making that clear to me. I'm going to be a believer now. No, it's all of the Lord. If you would be saved, it will be all of grace and all of God. But I would be remiss, you would be remiss, if you didn't remind a lost and dying world that one day, and it might be today, you will face the omnipotent God of the universe. Under what conditions will that be? That's where human responsibility comes in, right? Will you reject Christ yet again today? Will you, who do profess Christ, continue to believe in a God of your own making? Will you have a God who's your servant, or will you be His? You know the safest answer. Are there any questions?